This is Audible.
HarperCollins presents The Echo Man by Sam Holland, read by Sarah Lambie and Leighton Pugh.
He who fights with monsters might take care lest he thereby become a monster, and when you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil, 1886. Prologue. Leaves crunch underfoot. The black closes around him. He exists only in the narrow tunnel of light from the car's headlights. He takes a deep breath in. The forest smells of wet foliage, mud, clear, crisp air. So far it has been as good as he imagined it would be. It's all coming together perfectly. He's holding a woman, one arm hooked under her knees, the other around her back. She's still fresh, and blood runs out of the stab wounds, down his white plastic trousers. He savours the warmth on his cold hands. He looks at her fondly for a moment, then heaves her into the boot. She lands with a heavy thud against the second body, her leg lolling out over the bumper. He pushes it inside. Everything has to be just right. He looks at them both, then leans down and undoes the handcuffs. Even in the darkness, he can see faint red and black marks on her wrist, made while she had a body responsive enough to bruise. He's pleased. It'll show what he did. He walks back to the front of the car, opening the passenger side door. He picks up the two implements left in the footwell, taking the cover off one of them. The stainless steel blade of the knife shines, clean and newly sharpened. It's his favourite. He knows it works best for instances like this, smaller and more precise than the one he used to kill. He takes both instruments back to the bodies, stops, looks at the girls. He's never done this out in the open before, in the dark. He doesn't like to be rushed, but needs must. He grabs an arm and tugs her half out of the car boot. He straddles her body, taking a good handful of hair. Blood flows, but he knows what he's doing. It doesn't interfere with his process. He changes position, pulling the body around so he can get access to the other side. Then he puts the knife down and picks up the other tool. It's bigger, heavier. The weight is reassuring. He does what he needs to do, and then with a final twist and pull, it's finished. He stands up, rearranges the bodies, then repeats the action on the second girl. This one is quicker. His technique is better second time round, and after, he pauses, standing back from the car and appraising the scene in the boot. It's not perfect. He sighs. It bothers him that he can't complete the tableau properly this time, that none of this is in the correct order, but he wants these to be found. He shuts the boot. With the heel of his shoe, he smashes out the right taillight. He walks over to the second vehicle, pulling off the plastic clothing, placing it in another bag to burn later. He climbs in and puts his hand on the ignition key, willing the old car to work. As it splutters into life and he drives away, he looks back at the car. From the outside, nobody can tell what lies within. Nobody can imagine what horrors are still to come.
Part 1. Day 1. Monday. Chapter 1.
I am so fucking bored.
The thought darts into her head, intrusive and distracting. She looks in the mirror above the sink. The expression on her face isn't lust or desire. It's boredom. Pure, unmitigated boredom. She's bent over the taps, the soap dispenser in front of her, the hand dryer to her left. She can see the man behind her, the man that's doing a below-average job of fucking her in the disabled toilets of the community centre, barely 15 minutes after dropping their children off at school. Her knickers are around her ankles, her skirt pulled up to her waist. He has his hand shoved under her bra, kneading her breast like unproven dough, the other gripping her hip as he thrusts into her. Ethan? Evan? Whatever, she thinks. She remembers his kid's name is Hayden. He said he was in the same class as Alice, pointing towards the throng of indistinguishable children running into the school as the bell rang. He stood out among the throng of yummy mummies in tight gym gear and hurried career women on their way to work. Short brown hair, a little skinny for her liking, but decent enough. No wedding ring. That was the only sign she needed before making the suggestion. He ignored hers, the platinum band now reflecting in the stark fluorescent lighting. She cringes as he spasms, coming with a suppressed cry, then slumping against her back. She wriggles out from underneath him and stands, pulling her skirt down, trying to preserve some sort of modesty. He has his back to her, cleaning himself up. He drops the piece of toilet roll and the condom into the loo, then flushes it. He refastens his belt, before opening the door and peering out nervously. "Jessica, right? Do you want to?" he asks. "Just go," she says. He leans over to give her a kiss, but she pulls back. "Thanks," he mutters awkwardly, closing the door. She locks it behind him and sits on the toilet. She shakes her head with disbelief, pulling her tights back on. "I'm so fucking bored," she thinks again. Jess has a shower when she gets home, washing away all traces of Ethan or Evan. She makes a cup of coffee and takes it out to the garden. It has stopped raining and the winter's air is cold and biting. She sits on the edge of one of the concrete steps, dressed only in a jumper and jeans, her feet bare, her hair still wet from the shower. She knows she can't stay out here long, but she enjoys the feeling of the cold on her body. Their garden is large and rambling. Overgrown grass, weeds pushing their way through the gaps in the paving slabs, shrubs no more than twigs. Her husband occasionally makes comments about the mess, but she tells him she likes it this way. Nature forging its own path, ignoring regulation or order. She finishes her coffee and looks down at her feet. The flesh has turned white, her toenails blue. She started to shiver slightly. It's time to go inside, and she turns her attention to what needs to be done before she picks Alice up from school. She used to work, but the balance with the school run was a nightmare. She doesn't miss it. She was just as bored then as she is now. But she liked the distraction it gave. Now there is nothing for her to focus on. Nothing to do. At school pickup, she nervously scours the crowd, but Ethan or Evan is mercifully absent. She hovers at the edge of the playground, ignoring the other mums as they chat, their banalities and anathema to Jess. The door opens and the children bound out one by one, directed by the teacher towards their mothers. And then there's Alice. Her curls are escaping from her hairband as she skips towards Jess, a huge grin on her face, her school bag still massive in comparison to her tiny body. Jess pulls her into a hug, then ushers her towards the car, listening to her chatter about her day. As she drives, she looks at her daughter in the rearview mirror. It astonishes her how she managed to create this beautiful, confident creature. Unselfconscious, lithe, full of energy. The only good thing to come from her, she thinks ruefully. Alice talks about Georgia, about Isabel, about Ned. Faceless kids Jess has never met. "What about Hayden?" she throws back to her daughter. Alice shakes her head. "I don't know him," she replies, and Jess is relieved. The last thing she needs is a forced playdate with the guy. They get home. Alice rushes off to her toys and Jess gets on with dinner. She's making beef in a red wine sauce tonight, chopping vegetables carefully, sautéing the meat. She hears her husband come in the front door and Alice runs to greet him. Jess barely looks up until she feels him behind her, kissing the back of her neck. "Smells good," Patrick murmurs into her hair. "Me or dinner?" she asks, and he laughs. She turns and watches him as he goes into the hallway. He's taking his suit jacket off as he walks, pulling the tie from around his neck. She takes him in objectively. Patrick's never been slim, but lately his metabolism seems to have been getting the better of him. His shirt strains at the neck. A belly pushes over the waistband of his trousers. She turns back to the hob. She's not being fair, she knows. He's devoted, compassionate, hard-working. All the good husband adjectives. She should be making the most of him, she thinks, pouring a glass of red wine from the bottle, then transferring the rest into the pan. She should be screwing him in public toilets rather than nameless strangers. Maybe then he wouldn't be so keen to get it elsewhere. She goes to take a swig from the glass of wine, but her hand is slippery from the cooking and it slips, smashing on the floor.
"Mummy?"
she hears Alice shout from the living room.
"It's okay, just drop something. Don't come in here."
She looks down, scowling at the spikes of glass on the tiles, the red from the wine flowing slowly outwards. One shard is curving from the floor, the sharp tip pointing towards the ceiling. Her feet are bare, shoes and socks unnecessary with their expensive underfloor heating, and she picks up her right foot, placing it down on the fragment. She slowly transfers her weight across. She hears a crack as the piece splinters, then senses the slight pop as her skin breaks and the glass enters the soft tissue. It feels good. She watches a slow trickle of blood ebb away from her foot, the bright red mixing with the lighter hue of the wine.
"Jess, what the hell are you doing?"
She feels Patrick's hands on her upper arms. He pulls her away from the mess, pushing her towards a chair. She sits down with a thump. He looks at her, his hands on his hips. She can tell he's angry, but he doesn't want to shout.
"You know better than this," he says, bending down and looking at the wound.
"Shit," he mutters under his breath, wincing as he pulls the slice of glass from the fleshy part of her forefoot.
"You're going to need stitches."
"I'll sort it," she says. "I'll get Nav to come over."
Patrick stands up and looks at her. He goes to say something, then stops himself.
"I'll get dinner finished," he says instead.
She pulls her foot around so she can look. The edges of the cut are straight and precise, but they gape apart, blood flooding from the incision. Patrick passes her a roll of kitchen paper, and she roughly wraps it around her foot, then hobbles off to the bathroom. Inside, she locks the door and sits on the closed lid of the toilet. She takes the first aid kit out of the cupboard and opens it up, resting it on the edge of the bath. It's more than your usual household plasters. A collection of bandages, gauzes, tape. Everything she might need for situations like this. She looks at the bottom of her foot again, then sets to work, pushing the sides of the cut together, drying the area around the wound, and sticking it as best she can with Steri-Strips. But it's still oozing blood. Patrick's right. It's going to need stitches. And she picks up her phone, sending a text. A response comes back immediately. "I'm at work, Jess. I'm on nights. Go to the minor injuries clinic like a normal person." She replies.
"I'm not a normal person, Nav. You know that. It can wait. When's the earliest you can come round?"
Three small dots appear. He's typing. Then a pause. She knows she pushes their friendship to the limit, but she can't bear to go to another drop-in centre. The same questions, over and over again. The same looks. The same suspicion. Her phone beeps.
"Fine. Tomorrow morning. I finish at the hospital at 8. then a follow-up. I can't keep doing this. She sighs and puts her phone down, bandaging her foot as best she can. She puts socks on. She needs to hide the injury from Alice. When she goes back into the kitchen, Patrick and Alice are sitting at the dining table, Patrick starting to serve dinner. She ruffles Alice's hair as she sits down, and her daughter looks up, beaming at her.
Everything okay? Patrick asks.
She gives him the response he wants, a smile and a nod. She wonders, not for the first time, what's wrong with her. They eat dinner, and Alice tells them about her day at school. It's a ramble of words, an incoherent telling of a story, but they listen, the indulgent parents of a 5-year-old only child. Patrick asks her questions at the right points as she babbles away. She doesn't notice any hostility between her parents. Jess runs her bath and puts her daughter to bed. She reads her a story. Everything is calm. Alice snuggles down under her duvet and gives her a kiss and a cuddle. Her daughter smells of shampoo and warmth and innocence, and she feels a swell of love in her chest. She is thankful, for the 100th time, that her daughter is normal. Patrick comes in after her and says goodnight, turning off the light. Jess waits in the hallway as he closes the door, but he walks past her without a word, going downstairs. She follows him into the kitchen, hovering in the doorway as he takes a beer from the fridge.
I'm sorry, Patrick, she says,
and he nods slowly without looking at her. He opens the bottle and puts it to his lips, downing a long swig.
I'm going to London in the morning, he replies. It's an early start. I'll sleep in the spare room so I don't wake you.
He pauses.
I'll set up an appointment with Dr. Crawford.
Without another word, he turns and goes into the living room. She can't stand the thought of another insufferable hour with Dr. Crawford, a woman who doesn't care or understand. She asks Jess questions she can't answer. What makes you want to hurt yourself? What do you think will happen if you continue to be this self-destructive? Jess recognizes the threat implicit in the seemingly innocent question. She hears the television turn on and the sound of football. Patrick knows she hates football. He's telling her, "Stay away. I don't want to be near you right now." She doesn't blame him. She doesn't want to be near herself right now either. She goes to bed. She watches television in their bedroom, some true crime documentary, but the overblown drama doesn't provide the distraction from her own life that she hoped it would. After a while, she hears Patrick clean his teeth, then close the door to the front bedroom. She wonders if she should go and say goodnight, apologize again, then decides against it. An apology means, sorry, and I'll try not to do it again. Useless words, when she knows they're not true. She turns the television off, plunging the room into darkness. She lies in the black, counting slowly as she breathes in and out. Her daughter is silent next door. She can't hear any movement from Patrick in the spare bedroom. Slowly, she drops off to sleep. As night takes over, a hand slowly pushes the letterbox open. Liquid is poured through into the hallway. It runs across the tiles, soaking the doormat. Then something else follows. A lit match. It falls to the floor and with a whoosh the fire ignites.
Hampshire Chronicle, 15th of July, 1994. Animal killer still at large. 12 cats knifed. A sadistic pet killer is on the rampage, estimated to have killed 8 cats and injured a further 4 in the last 2 months. Other animals may have also been targeted, the RSPCA claim, citing 2 dogs and 4 rabbits that have gone missing in the same time period. Mother of 2, Michelle Smith, says her kids are traumatized after they returned home on Friday to find their pet cat Stimpy dead and disemboweled in their front porch. Anonymous sources from the police have also shared instances where pets have been found skinned, possibly while they were alive, although this has yet to be confirmed. The RSPCA and Hampshire Constabulary are working together to find the killer and ask any members of the public noticing suspicious behaviour to call 101. They advise any pet owners in the area to keep all animals indoors until the offender has been apprehended.
Chapter 2. The glass glows red and orange, flames lighting up the windows, turning the inside to black. Smoke claws up the walls, grey fingers reaching skywards. With an almost silent surge across the carpet, the fire grasps at curtains, furniture, anything in its wake. Glass cracks with the heat, dark wisps creep up the stairs, skulking under doors. It steals into her nose. The coughing wakes her, the lack of oxygen forcing her to take sharp breaths. Jess opens her eyes. It is nearly pitch black, but she can see a fog lurking at the edges of the ceiling. It hovers, a malingering spectre, thick and intimidating. She coughs again, feeling her lungs starting to clog. Suddenly, through her daze, her consciousness clicks into life. She jumps out of bed, dressed only in her oversized t-shirt, and goes to the door. The handle is cold, and she slowly opens it into the hallway. The entire first floor landing is filled with smoke. Instinctively, she drops to her knees, her heart racing as she crawls across the carpet. She glances down the stairs, recoiling from what she sees. The front door is obscured. The whole of the hallway is filled with flames. A lake of fire licks at the edge of the stairwell. The crackling terrifies her, eclipsing every other sound. And then she realizes the smoke alarms. She looks upwards through the grey, staring at the redundant white discs on the ceiling. Why aren't they going off? Why haven't they woken Patrick or Alice? The thought of her family boosts her into action. She screams her husband's name over and over, choking, coughing as she crawls across the hallway floor, feeling the heat of the flames behind her. She pulls the door open to her daughter's room, rushing over and trying to shake Alice awake. The smoke is thicker in here, almost filling the room to the floor. She knows they don't have much time. But Alice doesn't move, her eyes staying closed, her breathing laboured. The porch is below the window in the spare bedroom where Patrick is sleeping. She looks back, praying her husband has already made his escape. There is no way they can get there. The hallway floor is now a blanket of flames, red and yellow, arching to the ceiling. She can feel the heat, the carpet starting to melt under her knees. Jess kicks the door closed, frantically trying to think of an alternative way out as she pulls her unconscious daughter into her arms. She drops as low as she can to the floor and edges to the window. It's a two-story drop to the garden. She knows the moment she opens the window, the gust of oxygen will add fuel to the flames, and she peers through the blackening glass. The lawn is below them, but still. With a freezing frost, it could be as hard as concrete. But stay here, and both of them will almost certainly die. Coughing uncontrollably now, she pushes the window open. The fresh air is soothing to her lungs, but instantly she hears the roar of the fire gain strength behind her. Awkwardly, Alice still in her arms, she pulls herself up onto the windowsill. Her legs dangle out into nothing. She looks at her daughter's face. She can't tell if Alice is breathing, and panic takes over. She looks down into the dark and jumps. Her body crumples as she hits the ground and she collapses onto the cold grass, Alice on top of her. She feels her head hit something hard, the edge of the concrete patio. The adrenaline makes her shake, and she looks up at her house. Every window is lit up,
bright red and yellow dancing behind. The living room bay next to them has smashed, blown outwards by the ferocity of the blaze. She tries to move, but her head spins. She's dizzy, nauseous, and she lies back on the grass, taking deep gulps of air. She hears sirens, sees flashing blue lights in the road. People arrive. A man dressed in reflective yellow stands next to her, calling for medical assistance on his radio. She sees ladders, her house swarming with motion. Her daughter is pulled out of her arms. She grabs at air. "Where are you taking her?" she gasps as she watches Alice being carried away. A paramedic appears at her side. "Your daughter's safe now. We'll get her to the general. You won't be far behind." Jess feels his hands all over her, checking for injuries. "I'll give you something to take away the pain," he says. "I don't..." she starts, but she's too tired to argue as the needle is thrust into her arm. A fireman stands over her. "Who else is in the house?" he shouts.
"Patrick," she mutters. "My husband. Front bedroom."
The message is relayed and she lies back on the grass. The paramedic is trying to talk to her, but she can't hear him. She thinks of nothing but her daughter. A mask is put over her face, a rigid collar fastened around her neck. She feels the grass in her hair, the damp seeping into her t-shirt. The heat from the fire is replaced by a cold wind as they roll her one way, then the other, onto a stretcher. Her brain can't catch up with what just happened. The fire, the speed it spread, the flames destroying her house. She wants Patrick. Every part of her wills Alice to be okay. "Take me," she thinks. "Take everything from me except my daughter." The emotion overwhelms her and she starts sobbing, her tears making clean lines in the black soot on her face. She is carried into an ambulance. A paramedic stays next to her as they head towards the hospital, sirens blaring, and he takes one of her hands in his. "We'll be there soon," he says. His face is kind, understanding. "Do you need anything else for the pain?"
"No,"
she whispers. Everything is numb, she thinks. Her whole world is numb. Day 2. Tuesday. Chapter 3. The police officer standing at the edge of the cordon looks pale. The day is freezing, the grass crisp with cold, puddles frozen solid. She climbs out of the car. Her breath blows out in smoky plumes. She stamps her feet, trying to keep warm. Behind her, D.S. Noah Deakin finishes his cigarette and discards it, stubbing it out with the toe of his shoe. "Ready?" she asks him, and he nods, his mouth already set in a grim line. A crime scene guard presents them with the head-to-toe white suits and they pull them on, wobbling awkwardly on one leg, then the other, putting plastic covers over their shoes and a double layer of gloves on their hands. They push under the tape and walk down the path, negotiating their way across the stepping plates put there by the scene of crime officers already flooding the woods. In the dim light, they seem otherworldly, ghostly figures moving between the trees. She sees the occasional flash of a camera documenting the scene. The car was found at 5 a.m. A man walking his dog noticed bloody lines on the bodywork and a puddle of something red by the boot. The call woke her soon after that, jerking her rudely out of the darkness. She had dressed quickly, picking up Noah on the way. She sees the car. She recognises the make, a Ford Galaxy, beloved by many a mother on the school run. It's pale blue, old and slightly grubby. The back light is smashed, small fragments of red plastic on the ground. The boot is open, a tall figure peering inside. Large floodlights on metal frames have been put up around the car, the sudden brightness making her squint. The man notices them and stands up, stretching out his back.
"Detectives," he says,
She recognises his voice and posture. Straight, tall, middle class.
Dr. Ross, she replies. I'm DCI Kara Elliott. This is DS Deakin.
Detective Chief Inspector, they've sent the big guns in.
He sighs, turning back to the car.
What a fucking mess this is.
He stands back, allowing them to see inside. They both recoil, Kara's hand going to her mouth. She knew what was coming, but seeing it in person is still shocking. It's inhuman.
Fuck,
she hears Noah mutter next to her, his voice guttural and hoarse. She looks back to the boot, trying to stay dispassionate. A blanket has been pulled aside, revealing two dead bodies. She assumes them to be women. Their clothes are torn, tights ripped, bare legs. There is blood everywhere. Smudges and smears across the skin, clothes soaked, dyed red.
Any idea about cause of death? She asks.
Clear evidence of penetrating wounds on both girls, the pathologist says. Although I'll have to get them back to the mortuary to ascertain definitive COD. Time of death between 3 to 8 hours, but don't quote me on it. Rigor has set in. Bodies are still fairly warm.
And when will we get the post back?
Dr. Ross surveys the car.
Probably not before tomorrow. Give us 24 hours before you start nagging.
He passes Kara an evidence bag and she holds it up to the light. Two driving licenses are inside. She looks at their faces in the photos. They're young, 20 years old, with long brown hair, innocent smiles. Unrecognisable from what's in front of her now.
Found in their pockets, along with quite a bit of cash, Dr. Ross adds.
Not a robbery, then?
Not for me to say, Detective Chief Inspector.
Deakin takes the evidence bag from her and makes a note of the two names on the driving licenses. Kara forces herself to look back to the boot. The bodies are heaped on top of one another, abandoned with no thought for the victims. Plus the... She shakes her head, trying to get what she's seeing out of her mind. Who would do such a thing? Whoever it was had no boundaries, no hesitation. He, and she assumes it was a he, was devoid of compassion. Blood has run out of the car, pooling in the mud below. She notices two deep ridges running across the width of the bumper.
What do you make of these?
Kara asks Ross, pointing towards them. They are straight, about 6 inches long.
My guess?
Ross makes a downward chopping motion with his arm and Kara shudders.
Forceful enough to break through the black plastic. SOCO will take impressions when I'm done.
Kara's had enough. She moves away from the boot and opens the door to look in the back. There's blood pooled on the seats, splatters and drips up the sides of the car's interior and across the roof. She can see what she assumes to be vomit in the footwell. And even through her mask, the car smells of urine and sweat. Of fear. She clears her throat. She has a job to do.
Killed in here?
She directs backwards at Deakin, who looks over her shoulder.
Maybe. Did you see the marks on their wrists? Obviously restrained. He came prepared.
They look in the front, opening the glove box, peering under the seats. She wants to see for herself, although Kara knows the crime scene techs will do a full sweep, check for anything left behind. Biologicals, fingerprints, trace evidence. But there's nothing obvious here. Kara nods a goodbye towards Ross and they walk back down the track. Deakin holds the tape as Kara ducks under it. They pull off their suits and she bleeps the car open. They climb inside, relieved to get some respite from the freezing cold. Deakin lights a cigarette almost immediately and takes a long drag. He opens a window and blows smoke out into the cold air. She presses her fingers against her mouth, thinking, watching the SOCOs move around the scene. Two women dead. No more than girls. She remembers their clothes. Glittery tops, tights and short skirts.
On a night out? She says.
On a Monday?
He takes another drag and she looks at him. Noah Deakin is the sort of person that smokes as if he's been doing so since birth, and it fits with his overall look. Today he's wearing a slim-fitting shirt, tie loosely done up, dark jeans. On anyone else it would look scruffy. On Deakin, it's effortlessly cool.
Students? Kara suggests.
But what are they doing out here?
They're in the middle of nowhere, more than 10 miles from the closest town.
They're walking home. He picks them up, abducts them, she replies. She eyes his cigarette enviously. She's seen dead bodies before, sure, but nothing like this. What must have been going through their minds as he drove them here, as he handcuffed them? They must have been terrified.
Kara's phone rings, interrupting her chain of thought. She puts it on speaker.
Gov, are you at the scene?
The voice of their DC, a diligent, quiet guy by the name of Toby Shenton, fills the car.
We're here. Anything back on the plates? Kara asks him.
Reported stolen last night, he says, and Kara sighs. They're bringing the owner in for questioning.
Good. Noah's sending you the names of the victims now. I want to know everything about them by the time we get to the station.
You don't want me to... he stutters, and Kara interrupts him.
No, don't worry, Toby. I don't want you to notify the families. Leave that to us.
Next to her, Noah is rolling his eyes. She smiles indulgently.
Just do the background.
Gov. Shenton hesitates again.
Is it true what they're saying?
Kara frowns. It was bound to get out. Details about a double murder like this, so unique, so graphic, would find their way around the major crimes team in minutes as much as they tried to suppress it.
Yes, it's true.
The victims were... Kara glances to Noah. He takes another drag of his cigarette, staring out of the window.
She remembers the inside of the car. Two bodies, crumpled, broken. Two bloody necks, white bone, flesh, tendons visible. And two heads, lying alongside. Casually discarded, wet hair trailing in blood, glassy eyes wide open.
Yes, she says. Decapitated.
Chapter 4. Time passes in a blur. Jess remembers the ambulance, asking about Alice, about Patrick, being wheeled into the hospital, bright lights overhead. She remembers the doctors, different faces in her eyeline. When she wakes, she instantly knows where she is. She recognises the noises, the beeping, the chattering in corridors, the squeak of comfortable shoes on a lino floor. She recognises the feel of rough sheets against her skin. She's in a hospital ward. The blue curtain has been pulled around, isolating her from the rest of the patients. She hears a creak of someone shifting in the chair next to her, and she turns. There's a man there, a big guy, wearing a black jacket and scuffed jeans, with large, heavy boots.
"Who are you?"
she asks. Her voice is croaky, her throat sore.
"How are you feeling, Mrs. Ambrose?"
"A bit wobbly,"
she replies. But then she remembers, fear taking hold.
"Where's Alice? Where's my daughter?"
"She's in the ICU with your parents," the man says. "She inhaled a lot of smoke from the fire and was in respiratory distress from the carbon monoxide poisoning. But she's over the worst of it. She's going to be fine."
Jess tries to sit up, but her head swims.
"I have to see her," she mutters,
but the man shakes his head.
"Not yet, Mrs. Ambrose. I need to speak to you about how your husband died before we can let you see your daughter."
"My husband," Jess repeats. "Patrick's dead."
The man has the decency to look ashamed.
"I'm sorry, I thought you knew. They found a body in the spare bedroom. We're assuming that was your husband."
Jess nods slowly. She starts to cry.
what the hell had happened. How could Patrick be dead? He was there. He was just there, with her, at home. He was going to London today. Has anyone called his work to tell them? Has anyone spoken to his parents? Should she?
Could you tell me about last night? The man asks calmly.
You're police.
She recoils, her jaw clenching, heart beating, a familiar twitch of alarm.
I don't want to speak to you.
He sits up straight in his seat. He levels her with a stare. This isn't going to go away, Jessica, he says. The sooner you tell me, the sooner we can get this cleared up and you can see your daughter.
Cleared up? What do you mean? But then she realizes.
She glares at him through her tears.
You think I did it?
It was arson. Someone started that fire deliberately.
It wasn't me.
So tell me what happened.
He pauses, and she feels him studying her face for a reaction.
Don't you want to see Alice, Mrs. Ambrose?
He adds. She nods. Yes. She wants that more than anything. He hands her a tissue from the box on the bedside table, and she wipes her eyes and blows her nose. The snot on the tissue is black from soot. Jess shakes her head. I don't remember much. Honestly, I don't. I woke. I smelled smoke. I left my bedroom. The fire was everywhere. I grabbed my daughter and got out the only way I could see.
Did you call the fire brigade?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
I don't know. Why hadn't she called 999? It just hadn't occurred to her. In her panic, the only person she thought about was her daughter.
Why were you sleeping in a different room to your husband?
He had to get up early for work. He doesn't like to disturb me. The man nods, thinking. He isn't what she expects from a police officer. He's dark, solemn, with messy hair, and at least a week's worth of stubble. He has a smell about him, not unpleasant, but slightly musty, with diesel oil. It reminds her of a garage. What's your name? She asks. Detective...
Griffin, he says. And had you noticed anyone strange lately?
Strange?
Anyone you didn't recognise in your neighbourhood, watching you or your house? Had your husband mentioned anything odd?
She thinks back. No, nothing I can think of.
Does your house have CCTV or an alarm?
She shakes her head.
Pity.
Jess notices his gaze shift to her left forearm, to the straight silvery lines stark on her skin. Jess hurriedly pulls the bedsheet up to cover them. The smoke alarms, she remembers suddenly. They didn't go off. He nods again. He's not taking notes, just listening, the frown still on his face.
When did you last check them? He asks.
She can't remember. She opens her mouth and closes it again. She doesn't know what else to tell him to make him believe her. But then the curtain is pulled aside and a man appears in front of them. Griffin stands up and backs away as he takes in the lanyard and ID, the stethoscope around the man's neck.
Jess! I'm sorry. I came as soon as I heard. Are you okay?
Jess feels herself relax at the welcome sight of her friend. The doctor turns, acknowledging the other man standing at Jess's bedside.
Nav Sharma,
he says, going to offer his hand, but Griffin is already walking away, his head bowed, back hunched. Nav turns back to Jess, sitting down in the chair the detective has just vacated. He takes her hands in his.
Nav, have you seen Alice? She asks.
Yes. She's awake, but still on oxygen.
Confused, with a nasty headache. He smiles, but she can see the lost night's sleep and the worry on his face.
They're a great team on the ICU. She's in the best possible hands. And I know my goddaughter. She's strong. She's a fighter.
And Mum and Dad?
They're looking after her.
Jess feels marginally better, knowing her parents are there with her daughter. She imagines her mum gently stroking Alice's hair, her dad bustling around, ensuring everything is taken care of.
And how are you? Nav repeats softly.
His kindness starts her crying again, and he reaches forward, hugging her in a tight embrace. She leans into him. He smells of antiseptic and a long night on the wards. He slowly lets her go.
I'm sorry about Patrick, he says. He was... he...
And he stops talking, his mouth turned down, eyes closed. She smiles weakly at her friend, squeezing his hand. He takes a long breath in, pulling himself together, before turning his attention back to her. She knows Nav is more upset than he'll let on now, but his professionalism takes over.
Do they know?
Nav asks, but Jess cuts him off. Of course they know, Nav. It's written all over my medical records. She snaps more than she intends and instantly feels guilty. There's a pause and she knows Nav is looking at her. She doesn't like being the person he is seeing. Weak, sick, pathetic. Jess looks down, the soggy tissue still clutched in her fingers. She notices the black under her nails, lines of dirt from the fire etched into her skin.
And who was that? He says, eventually.
Police. He turns and looks in the direction Griffin has gone, but the corridors are empty.
They won't let me see Alice. They think I...
Jess's voice fades as Nav nods, his expression grave.
I know, your mum said.
You'll look after her, won't you?
Jess asks, feeling her eyelids start to droop. Her body is weary, needing the energy to recover. She takes comfort in Nav being next to her. He's her oldest friend since they met at their local dive bar at university. Nav had been part of a group of testosterone-fueled, ritual-drinking medical students. Jess had been on a quiet night out with friends. He had slurred an apology before puking on her shoes. The next day, somehow, he had tracked her down, presenting her with a brand new pair of trainers. It was an unexpected gesture, but something fully in keeping with the way Nav was. Polite, posh, preppy. She's always trusted him with her life. And now she trusts him with her daughters. She closes her eyes.
I promise, she hears Nav say as her mind slips away into nothingness.
Chapter 5.
Kara notices the whispers from her colleagues the moment she and Deacon walk into the police station. Two young women. Murdered. Heads removed.
Kara knows her every step will be watched to see how she handles the case. She's guessing there's already a pot going for time before first arrest. Not that anyone will admit publicly to something so callous.
Elliot!
Kara hears a bellow from the other side of the room and turns to see her detective chief superintendent heading towards her. DCS Marsh is a man under pressure, surviving off a surfeit of nicotine and caffeine with the pallor to match. His face is grey, hollows under his cheekbones, with a grubby mug in one hand. He takes a swig out of it now, winces, then instructs the nearest DC to fetch him a fresh cup. He gestures for Kara to follow him into her office, then rests his non-existent bum on her desk, crossing his arms.
"I hear the owner of the car is a dead end," he says, getting straight to the point.
Kara takes her coat off and sits down on her chair. "He has an alibi for last night," she confirms, repeating what Shenton had told them on the drive back from the crime scene. "But the families have been notified and the boyfriend of one of the girls is waiting downstairs." Their DC had been working hard and, sure enough, the two victims were students. Clever, hard-working, diligent women with bright futures and families in different parts of the country. She doesn't like to admit it, but Kara is glad it wasn't her that had to deliver the terrible news. She's done it too many times.
ashen-faced parents, distraught husbands, crying wives. There is no good way to tell someone their loved one has been brutally murdered.
Good. See what you can get out of him.
Marsh frowns, looking through the open door at the whiteboard in the incident room. Shenton has stuck photos of the victims along the top, their names written in black marker pen. Marisa Perez, Anne Lees. They smile out, oblivious of their futures. Snapshots taken from their student IDs.
Anything on CCTV?
Kara points to the computer at which Shenton's now sitting, Deakin leaning over his shoulder. On it. Marsh nods.
Keep me updated, he says.
Kara follows him into the incident room, then watches him walk back to his own office. As he goes, he takes the new mug of coffee, almost downing the scalding hot liquid in one on his way out. Deeks, she calls, and he turns. She tilts her head towards the door. Follow me, she's saying. Interview time. Rick Baker is young and fashionable and nervous. Boyfriend of a few months and clearly a fan of the gym. They've placed him in an interview room where he's been waiting for the last half hour, sweating through his shirt. Kara and Deakin sit down in front of him. They start the video and give the standard warnings for a voluntary interview, at which point he looks as though he might cry. Deakin leads. Time is of the essence, and Kara knows Noah has a way about him that men instantly bond with. He starts gently, expressing sorrow for his loss. The boyfriend nods, his lips clamped together.
Could you tell us when you last saw Marisa? Noah asks.
Yesterday. Lunchtime. We agreed we'd do something today. She wanted a girly night out with Anne.
Kara watches as the boy tries admirably to hold it together. Then his face crumples and he starts to cry. Deakin looks to Kara and raises an eyebrow a fraction. With that one expression, Kara knows what Noah's saying. He's either a traumatized boyfriend, or he's trying his hardest to look that way. Deakin hands him a tissue.
And where were they planning on going?
He says. Rick wipes his eyes. He blows his nose loudly.
Reflex, their usual. It's an 80s club in town. I should have gone with them. I should have insisted they got a taxi home for a change.
Kara sits up in her seat.
How did they normally get home?
They'd walk, but it was cold last night. They might have...
His voice trails off. He shakes his head.
They would sometimes hitchhike. Someone would always pick them up. Marisa laughed at me when I said I was worried about it. She'd say there's two of them. They'll be fine.
He looks up. His eyes are bloodshot.
Well, they weren't, were they?
Deakin leans forward, looking the poor kid in the eye.
You weren't to know, he says, quietly. And what were you doing last night?
Rick talks them through his evening. Working on an essay in his room. Went to bed about 11.
Did anyone see you?
Noah asks. Apparently not. They wrap up the interview. Rick leaves. Kara and Noah watch him as he pushes the double doors open, stepping out into the crisp January afternoon. Kara glances at Noah. He's deep in thought. Then he runs his hand across his hair.
Not our guy, is he?
He says. He's short, but he's strong. He could have easily done it. But... stolen a car, driven an hour out of town, murdered them like that? What would be the motive? Kara screws up her face. We've taken his samples. Who knows what forensics might show, but no, I don't think it was him.
So we're saying it's a random?
Deakin asks. They turn and walk back up the stairs to the office. Kara doesn't answer his question. She knows what he's thinking. The majority of murders are committed by someone close to the victim. An attack in a peak of rage. Obvious motives. Easy to find. Something like this, out of nowhere. It's tricky. They open the door to the incident room.
There's nothing for it but good, solid police work. CCTV, forensics, door-to-door, the boring stuff. Following up on witness statements until something pops out. She glances at the clock on the wall. It's 4 already. She knows she won't be home for dinner. Because below the clock are new photos, taken that morning from the crime scene. Shenton has obviously received them from the lab, and they demand her attention. She tears her eyes away from the dead women, the disembodied heads, to the rest of the car. The bloodied back seats, handprints across the doors, smears on the roof. She frowns. Deacon catches her expression. "What are you thinking?" he asks.
"It's just..." She taps one finger on the crime scene photo. "Everything about this scene screams frenzied attack. The stabbing, the blood. Up close and personal."
"Yes. And?"
"But the location, in the middle of nowhere, and the removal of their heads..." She looks at Noah. "That seems planned. He'd have needed tools, the right sort of knives." "And why decapitate them, Deeks? When would we expect to see that normally?"
"For easy disposal of the body."
"Right. But there's none of that here."
"Perhaps he changed his mind."
They stand, side by side, facing the board. Their postures mirror each other, arms crossed, identical frowns.
"Rape gone wrong?"
Noah suggests.
"They did something to piss him off. He lost control."
"Escalated pretty badly then," Kara mutters. "This was overkill." Kara doesn't want to add her last thought. Deacon knows what will be going through her head, but to say it out loud feels like tempting fate. "If this guy lost control," she thinks grimly, "it won't be just once. There's a high chance he'll do it again. And soon."
Chapter 6. When Jess wakes, the room is darker. She feels muddled, struggling to get a grip on how much time has passed. She looks to the chair by her side. Nav is slumped, his head at an uncomfortable angle, dark hair falling over his face, fast asleep. He's obviously been away and come back. A bag is by his feet, his coat draped over the chair. Even with Nav here, she feels sick and alone. She thinks about Patrick, about how they argued last night, about how they left things, without even a goodnight kiss. She starts to cry. Huge, racking sobs. All she wants to do is see her husband, to hold her daughter. Alice has lost her father. She should be with her. How can they possibly think she had anything to do with this? But then she hears voices outside the curtain. She stops and strains to listen. Hushed, urgent tones. Something important.
"Just because the smoke alarms didn't have batteries doesn't mean she murdered her husband."
She recognises the voice. The male detective again, gruff and annoyed.
"No, but her fingerprints were on the watering can that held the paraffin. What does that say to you?"
A woman this time, obviously not happy.
"And she has form. Have you even read her file?"
"No, of course you haven't." Jess's mind is reeling. Somehow she still believed that the fire had been an accident. That some faulty wiring or damaged plug had caused a spark. But this... And they know about what happened 2 years ago. About...
"I don't agree."
"Griffin, with all due respect, I don't give a shit. You are not working for the police. This is not your case. You shouldn't even be here."
Jess lifts her head, and through a tiny gap in the curtain she can see the woman's face. Mouth pinched, eyes cast down. She looks as if there's 100 things she's holding back from saying.
"Have you asked her about the earring?"
"Seriously, Griffin, this theory of yours..."
"Have you?"
The fucking earring has nothing to do with the other cases. This is a separate investigation. My investigation. Not everything is connected.
A pause. An intake of breath, then a long sigh.
Fine. As soon as the doctor clears her, we'll arrest her and we can ask.
And when will that be?
Right now, if it were up to me. But she had a nasty fall and I don't want her keeling over in a cell.
The man goes to say something, but she cuts him off.
Seriously, Griffin, enough. Stay away from my suspect. I'm warning you.
Jess listens to footsteps as the woman stomps away, then closes her eyes quickly as a hand pulls back the curtain. She imagines the man standing there. The man who's apparently not a detective, who seems to be on her side. Then hears an exhale as the curtain is replaced and his heavy boots fade into the distance. She opens her eyes again and feels tears prickle behind them. She puts her hand up, tentatively feeling the bandage. She looks at the drip going into her arm. She's stuck in a hospital bed with a detective poised to arrest her, who believes she killed her husband and tried to kill her daughter. A daughter who she's not allowed to see, who she can't hold in her arms and comfort and tell her that everything will be okay. What sort of mother is she? She can explain her fingerprints. It was probably her watering can that she'd used 100 times before in the garden. But the paraffin, that she doesn't know. And she's seen the shows on Netflix. She knows that once the police have a theory, that's all they'll go after. They're blinkered, blind to any other possibilities. She's met police like this woman before. Cold, unfeeling eyes, seeing her as one thing and one thing alone and never changing their mind. She remembers the pull of her arms behind her, the cold metal on her wrists, sharp gravel against her cheek. She remembers the feeling of complete helplessness and the certain knowledge that she was never going to let that happen again. Her mouth feels dry and fuzzy, so she reaches over and takes a drink from the glass of water on the table. It's warm. She looks at Nav. He's fast asleep, leaning to one side. Jess knows what she has to do, and she has to do it now. She sits up. Her head spins and she feels slightly sick, making it hard to get out of bed. Hard, but not impossible. She looks at the cannula in her arm and removes the dressing, then pulls the needle slowly out. Red blooms at the injection site, and she picks up a tissue from the box next to her, pushing it hard against it. She shuffles around, both feet now on the floor. She stands up slowly and glances at Nav, but he hasn't stirred. She feels the cold waft around her. She's wearing no more than a backless hospital gown. She can't see her t-shirt anywhere and realises with a jolt that the detectives probably have it as evidence. She opens the cabinet next to her bed and says a silent thank you to her mother. A few basic toiletries and a pile of brand new clothes have been left. Underwear, tracksuit bottoms, a jumper. She puts them on, along with socks and a pair of trainers. With the brush and elastic tie, she pulls her hair back into a high ponytail, doing her best with her dishevelled appearance. She forces a smile onto her face. This will work. It has to. She goes over to Nav and gently pulls his bag away from his feet. Jess rests it on the bed, scrabbling inside. Her fingers come in contact with cold metal and she pulls the car keys out. As an afterthought, she takes whatever cash is in his wallet.
Sorry, Nav, she whispers.
She knows this is a bad idea. She knows that when she is injured, the worst thing she can do is ignore a doctor's advice. But this is different. This is an emergency. But to leave her daughter? On wobbly legs, she pushes the curtain aside. The ward seems empty, so she walks out. She follows the signs to the ICU. Doors open automatically as she goes. It's late and the corridors are deserted. Her progress goes unchallenged. But then she stops.
A man stands in the doorway in his recognisable black uniform, waiting, guarding, hands behind his back. He nods, smiling, as a doctor goes past him into the ICU, and Jess knows there's no way she's going to see her daughter tonight. She ducks back around the corner, breathing heavily, on the edge of tears. She had just wanted to check on Alice, hold her warm hand, kiss her, tell her that everything was going to be okay. But Mum and Dad are there, she tells herself. She remembers the hundreds of times in her past that her parents had commanded the doctors, sitting patiently by her bedside, for however long it took. She may not be able to see Alice, but they are the next best thing. She turns. She could go back to her ward, put her faith in the police that they would find out the truth. But the unease that follows that thought quickly pushes it out of her head. She starts to walk again. She passes two nurses chatting in the corridor and smiles at them confidently. "Cigarette," she mutters. They scowl but let her go without question, and she breathes a sigh of relief when she's clear. She looks for signs for the main entrance. Her heart is thumping in her chest the whole time, convinced that at any moment someone is going to see her and pull her back to her ward, this time in handcuffs. But perhaps it's too late or people are too weary. Either way, nobody stops her. She sees the double doors of the main entrance in front of her. There are more people here. Nurses getting coffees at Costa, the bored receptionist checking her computer. All it would take would be for one person to recognise her, and it would be game over. "Hey!" A voice speaks next to her, a hand grabbing at her sleeve. She turns, her breath caught in her throat.
"You drop this,"
the man says, holding out a £5 note. She takes it, her hand shaking.
"Thank you,"
she croaks.
"Can I help you with anything?"
he asks.
"No, no, I'm fine. Just going out for a cigarette."
She smiles. The expression feels strained.
"In this weather?"
he asks. She looks at the doorway. The rain is coming down in sheets, puddles flooding the concrete. She doesn't have a coat. He seems dubious. He's looking at her as though she's a mental patient, escaped from the wards on level 3. She smiles again.
"I won't be long."
She forces a laugh. "They've cut me off from my methadone, so nicotine's the only drug I'm allowed." The tactic works, and the man backs away from her.
"Well, look after yourself,"
he says, and hurries away. The rain is worse than she anticipated. She's soaked in seconds, clothes sticking to her body, water dripping over her face. She moves as quickly as she can towards the staff car park, freezing, head dizzy, guessing at the location of Nav's black Renault Clio. She walks down the rows of the top floor of the multi-story, pressing the button on the car keys over and over again. The wind is whipping through the soaking jumper and she starts to shiver. And then, at last, a flash of orange. She says a silent prayer, thanking Nav for being a man of routine, and heads towards the car, throwing herself inside, shutting the door against the wind and the rain. But go where? There's Nav. She could go to his house, hide until he comes home. Her parents, too, but they're still at the hospital with Alice. She realises with a jolt she doesn't have any other friends. At least, not close ones where she could knock on their door at the dead of night and say, "Hey, would you like to harbour a suspected murderer?" But she knows there's only one place to go. She wants to go home. Chapter 7. The house barely stands. The blue and white police tape flaps, bedraggled ribbons in the wind. Jess parks the car behind a white panel van and turns the engine off. She stares through the open window. She can hear cars passing a few roads over, but otherwise the street is quiet. It's 5:34 p.m. The sight of her ruined home is horrifying, but she can't look away. A broken mess of black and grey,
The roof on the left-hand side has gone, collapsed into where she knows the front bedroom would have been, where Patrick had been sleeping. A sob bursts out of her and she starts to shake as she cradles her head in her hands. If they hadn't had the argument, he would have been sleeping in the same bed as her. He would have been alive.